For members only, Golf Smarter, number 441, published on June 17, 2014.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Short game and wedge questions answered with Terry Kaler.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, Terry.
Thank you, Fred. It's good to be back.
All right. We teased everybody long enough. If you are a Golf Smarter member and you want to take advantage of the 15% discount, GS member is your checkout code. But you've got to go and do the online fitting. Explain the online fitting for the Score Golf wedges, the scoring clubs.
What we've done is created an online process called Score Fit that takes you through a 5-minute exercise. We're going to dive deep into some of your thoughts and experience with your scoring range performance and your short irons. We're going to find out what kind of irons you play so we can reconcile the vast array of specifications and lofts and lies and links out there. And then at the end of Score Fit, you're going to get a presentation of what your optimum score golf system would look like, 5 clubs to replace your 9 and your P club, which you'll find on our website why you should do that. Very clear reasons. And then your wedge lofts, if you will, so that the last 4 or 5 clubs in your set make up a very precise scoring system. After that, we'll also go in and take the rest of your answers and prepare for you a very comprehensive report on ways you might look to improve your scoring in technique and your approach to the game.
Well, then that leads in perfectly to a question that just came in recently to the Short Game Academy. Again, if anybody wants to submit a question there, just go to thewedgeguy.com and there's a link on Terry's site. You'll see the Golf Smarter logo and click on that and you'll be able to submit a question. And if it comes to me, I will forward it along to Terry for you. But this question came from Matthew Edwards in Durham, North Carolina. And he says, I'm interested in getting some score wedges and interested in your thoughts on whether those of us that play blades should replace our 9 irons and pitching wedges with score wedges. I understand the need if you play cavity backs, but I play MP68s and wonder if dropping the 9 and pitching wedge would be a smart move. I really do not like the existing wedges, and that is why I'm interested in score golf. I dislike wedge, or I don't know what he's saying here. He has it in quotes, so I'm not sure. I dislike it so much that I bought an extra MP68 PW. I see his W wedge, I think is what he's saying, or a sandwich, and had it bent to a GW loft. The Vokey I have in the bag at 54 degrees feels like an alien compared to the blades.
I'm not going to comment on that last comment, but here's my thought. And we know that this golf club outperforms anything in the wedge category in the higher laws, 48 and up. We know that it seriously outperforms anything in the thin face cavity back. And when I say that, I'm talking about your distance dispersion patterns are about 90% built into your golf club and 10% your fault. I mean, people complain about, I can't control the distance of my wedges. I've bought all the top brands. You know, I'm pretty good with my 7, 6, 7, 8 iron, but I'm terrible with my 9 and pitch. It must be me. Well, guys, I'm just going to give you absolution. It's not you. It's the clubs you're playing. They throw horribly broad dispersion patterns based on our experience watching them on Iron Byron. You move impact up and down the face, you're going to get wildly different distance deliverables. It's not your fault. And Score has a solution for that. With regard to this listener and your Mizunos, I will tell you this. Buy the full set of scores. Hit the 9 equivalent and the P equivalent against your Mizunos. And if they're not better, send them back. And we'll refund that part of your set. How's that?
That's an amazing offer and one that you've stood by forever.
Well, when you make a product like this, you can back it up because we have had, less than 1% of the golfers send these clubs back and say, they just don't work for me. And on about 2/3 of those, we've helped them get the right shaft in their scores and send them back, and then they do work for them. Nobody talks about shafts and scoring clubs. People go, well, I always play steel shafted wedges. That's what I'm ordering. don't order your Hyloft club based on what you've always played in your wedges. Order them based on the iron shafts you have, because those are the shafts you're used to. We want to give you a seamless transition from your 6, 7, and 8 right on into your set of scores. And we do that by getting the weight and the flex in your shaft match and the material matched.
There was a question that actually I saw that I wanted to come back to because it kind of fit what you were just saying. Somebody here, Stephen Davis of Colorado Springs, says, when I was fitted for irons, they made a big deal about getting the right flex. However, when I purchased wedges, it seemed like they were all the same flex. Do you think there's any need for different flexes in those wedges?
My answer is unequivocally yes. And I was with a very well-known head golf professional, and I won't mention him because he's on staff for a major brand. We were doing a fitting with some of his members who had requested it, and he made the comment, I had no idea the shaft and the Hyloft clubs had that much impact.
Wow.
And we watch people totally change their launch conditions, their dispersion patterns, everything by getting them in the right shaft. You know, we select the shaft based on the weight match to our profile, our strength profile, and the flex match to our strength profile. But, you know, our clubs that we call wedges are full swing golf clubs. They are just an extension of our iron set. Why would we not want that extension to be as seamless and as smooth a transition as we possibly could have?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about hitting the ball. We've talked about the equipment. Let's talk a little bit about improving your scoring, because this is the place where everyone has an issue, from low handicap to high handicap golfers. They all seem to be asking the same type of shot, having the same type of problems. This one, let's see what he says. Okay, so the different types of grips that should be using on a chip versus a pitch shot. Does the length of the chip or the pitch shot change the grip? What about the grip pressure?
Well, I'm a believer, first of all, and grip, I'll start at the back end of that. The grip pressure, I think, is something that you want to keep as constant as possible. But the closer the shot, the more delicate the shot, you really want to hold the club lighter, because that gives you more feel and more precision. So you're going to grip the club lighter on a little soft pitch over the collar. You're going to fly the ball 8 or 10 feet, let it run down to the hole. You're obviously going to hold the club a lot lighter on that shot than you would if you were hitting a full 8 iron or full 5 iron. But even then, I'm a big believer in light grip, and the vast majority of golfers hold the club too tightly. And we grip down because of other pressure, and you know, we're trying to make sure we don't hit it left or this or that. But grip pressure being light is one of the most fundamental things about golf. Moving your hands up and down the grip, I think, is a very good idea. When you're the more delicate the shot, the more precise your impact needs to be to, and the club speed needs to be to get that exact carry and roll you're looking for, work slower and get closer to your work. And getting closer to your work means, you know, move your hands down on that grip. I'm not a big believer in getting all the way down on the steel, but close to it. And that lets you have, you know, less error, because you're, as I say, you're closer to your work. You flex your knees a little more, you're down a little more, and you're moving that club slower. So we use a grip that Lambkin builds for us that we really like, because it's an inch longer than a standard golf grip, and it has less taper in it. So from your normal hand position, you grip down an inch, grip down another inch, even another inch, the club doesn't dramatically change the feel in your fingertips. So it, because it's the, pretty much the same taper. And we really like that grip because it facilitates scoring range control.
And that does, obviously it affects the pressure that you have in your hands. That's why so many guys are putting the fat grips on their putters now, because just to loosen the grip, to loosen the pressure on their hands.
No, I agree. And, you know, one of the trends, and I play one of those in the smaller size, but I think it works really well. I haven't gone to the real big ones. I like the smaller size of these larger putter grips. But a trend that we see a lot is people going to bigger grips in their irons and woods. And I don't think that's a very good idea, because people like the feel of the larger grip because they're gripping the club too much up in their palm. I'm kind of drifting from that question, but
it's okay.
The golf and go back. And again, I'll go back and direct you to Mr. Hogan's five lessons. And there's a whole chapter on how to hold a golf club. And there is one really correct way to hold a golf club. And it doesn't matter whether you overlap or interlock or even full fingered. The golf club has to be held in the fingers for the hands to work properly through impact. And when you get that big grip and get that club up in your palms, it is costing you significant yardage because you're taking the accelerator of your proper hand action. You just removed it. And a friend of mine once used the term, he holds it like a ham sandwich. And there's so many bad grips out there. And this game is impossible to play with a bad grip. You got on the PGA Tour, you do not see bad grips out there.
And the other thing that I've noticed on the short game shots, the chipping and pitching, not only do you see a lot of white knuckles, I mean, you see people really squeezing the grip, and then you can see it in their shoulders. You see the tension in their neck, in their mouth, in their jaw. I mean, there's clearly a lot there. But I've also noticed that on the chipping and the pitching, when you're not taking a full swing, it seems like people tend to try to sweep the club more than descend on it and come down on the ball and, you know, get through the ball. And then they don't understand why the ball releases all the way across the green.
Well, people have a misperception of the two things. One is this term accelerate through the ball. So you've got more of these jabby type techniques out there. And the reality of it is almost impossible to decelerate a golf club. You can change the rate of acceleration, but you know, if the club starts at zero at the top of the backswing, you know, on a short shot, it's pretty hard to move it fast and then slow it down. What people do is they start the downswing too quickly. And the best tip I ever had in my life, one of the best short game practitioners in amateur golf I ever saw, back at my days at Fair Oaks Ranch in San Antonio. And Dave was just beautiful around the greens. And we had this delicate surgeon's touch. And his simple swing thought was, take the club back slowly to the end of where I think it needs to go, the end of the backstroke. And then I feel like gravity just lets my hands and my arms and the club drop into the golf ball. He didn't think about accelerating at all because he just thinks gravity. He said, right before I take it back, I just think gravity. And that was his tempo thought. And it's really if anybody's having trouble with their short pitches and their chip shots, it's a pretty good swing thought to mess around with. And, you know, we get this accelerate through the ball so ingrained. Well, if I start at zero and I get to the ball at 2 miles an hour, I'm still accelerated.
And what about the other thing I've come to my own personal realization is especially on the short game, is that when I'm taking not a full swing, that if I keep my wrist, my left wrist, my forward wrist, from breaking, and keeping it, the back of my hand towards the target and not following through all the way and coming up high, has a huge impact on the direction of my chipping.
Absolutely. And the easiest way to think about chipping and pitching is that as you start into your downswing, the back of the left wrist passes the ball before the club head gets to it. And if you always make sure that happens, I don't like to think about hitting down on the ball, but if you make, because I think that changes my hope. I don't want to hit down on the ball. I want to hit a golf shot and I want to make a swing. I don't want to hit the ball at all. I don't want to hit anything. I want to take this club back and through in an orientation that's going to make the ball do what I want it to do. And if you always just think about the back of the left hand gets past if there's a plane of glass at the golf ball, that back of that left hand breaks that pane of glass. That club head doesn't break it. It's already broken when the club head gets there. A little different pane of glass example than the one used in Five Lessons that talked about swing plane. But I'm talking about what gets to the ball first.
Good. Thank you. Question from Matt in Brentwood. How do we know which scoring club to use from the sand? A very frequent question. Are different types of sand a factor?
Well, different types of sand are a factor in bunker play. The tour pros don't have to deal with that because they play tour quality sand every week, but the rest of us do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, when you walk in the bunker, I walk into the bunker typically with two clubs in my hand, and it might be my 55 and 58 if it's a shorter bunker shot. It might be my 51 and 55 if it's a longer bunker shot. I've hit bunker shots with my 47. But all of the score sole designs are designed to make them a good bunker club. And I look at the bunker shot as how far do I need to carry it? How far do I want it to roll out? And I don't want to have to take a big old cut in the sand. And so I will typically, if I've got a longer bunker shot, which typically means you got a lot of green to work with on a longer bunker shot, I very often will lay open a 51 or even a 47 and make the same bunker swing I'd make with a 58 on a shorter shot. It's going to come out lower. It's going to roll out more. And, you know, to me, getting up and down out of bunkers is, you know, going to be a relative rarity for the average amateur player. What you're trying to do is not make more than three shots from that bunker.
Right.
Get it on the green. Give yourself a putt somewhere in the 20-foot or less range. You're not going to hurt yourself. You hit it in the bunker. You've already kind of gunched this hole a little bit. And get it out of the bunker. And unless you have a place where you like to go practice bunker shots an hour or two a day, you know, getting up and down out of the bunker is going to be the exception rather than the rule.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the best guys on tour are two-thirds, and they do this for a living. So,
yeah. Yeah, let's get our expectations in check here, because we are not tour players, and we think that we have all those shots in our bag because we saw somebody on TV do it.
Right. I would tell your listeners, all of it, if you played tour bunker sand, we'd all be 10 times better bunker players if we got to play the sand they play.
Oh, that's
because
so interesting.
They're watered down. Let me tell you something I learned the other day, and I didn't know this. It's been several months ago. Watch the telecast, and the caddies always go into the bunker on the side of the bunker away from the hole, and they rake the bunker directly away from the flag. So the bunker rake grooves go from that spot right toward the flag, because it's an easier bunker shot to hit it with the grooves than across the grooves. And do they do that out of courtesy? No, they do that because they get fined if they rake it any other way.
Oh.
I mean, these guys got a lot of advantages. There's also a tour sand texture. Go watch the guys on the tour walk into bunkers. They don't really grind their feet into the sand because the bunkers are so firm. They don't need to. They'll move them a little bit, but you don't see those guys walk into these fluffy bunkers and bury their feet like we have to sometime and then figure out how to get out of this talcum powder stuff.
Tell me why we bury our feet like that. Why do we bury our feet like that in bunkers?
Just so that your feet won't move when you go into your swings.
Okay.
Give you a stable platform.
Yeah. Okay. Derek wants to know, all conditions being equal, what do you think has more control for in-between distance shots, stepping up on a gap wedge or easing up on the pitching wedge?
Neither one. First of all, your gaps are too big if you're playing conventional golf clubs. You have a 20, 25-yard, 15-yard gap in there, probably at the very least. The easiest way to hit the in-between shots for a recreational golfer particularly, but even for tour players, is take the longer club, grip down on it 3/4 inch, and just swing it.
That's it? Really?
That's it. Yeah, it'll cut your gap about in half.
Oh.
Never go amp up a wedge or a short iron, because what happens is you swing harder, the ball goes higher, and it goes shorter probably.
Uh-huh.
Phil Mickelson can tell you all about that. He lost the U.S. Open by doing that, actually, now that you think about it.
You know, I had a great conversation a couple episodes ago with Dave Stockton. Really?
Ooh.
Oh, it was. Oh, really? You got to go back and listen to that one. That was absolutely amazing. We spent well over an hour together on the phone, and it was not just on putting, and it was definitely a lot of the mental game, but course management in a way, or not, I don't want to say course management, strategy beyond course management, the mental side of strategy that I thought was so fascinating. But one of the, yeah, and you know, he's just a wealth. It was remarkable. One of the things that really stood out to me that he said was, when I step up to the ball on my short game and I'm looking at the shot, there is one of two shots that I have, a low one or a high one.
Interesting.
Yeah. You want to respond to
just
that?
Break it down that simple, right?
Yeah, he says, I'm either going to make a low shot or a high shot. That's all I'm thinking about.
Wow.
I'd love to get your response to that.
We make it a lot more complex than that.
And that's why he's the one who's coaching Rory McIlroy and Phil Mickelson and not us.
Right.
You have a response? You have something you want to say about that?
But, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense. And then, you know, whether he's doing that with the same club or not, but he's narrowing it down to two techniques, or you could narrow it down to two clubs. You know, you could go and say, you know what, I have a really good chipping technique, a really good, you know, chip pitch technique. And when I get to a shot, you know, I'm a multi-club guy, God, I'm just blanking on his last name. But, you know, a lot of the teachers are, really get good with your Stan Utley and, you know, learn how to hit all the shots. I don't think there's a wrong approach. My approach is I'm a recreational player. I don't play as much as I want to. I don't have that kind of command over my 55 or 51 anymore. And I go up and I look at it. It's like, you know, what club with my chipping stroke, my basic learned stroke, is going to get the flight and the rollout that this shot demand. And if it's, you know, use a 58, I hit a 58. If it's use a, you know, 43, I'm going to chip with a 43. And on a lot of shots that I run to, it's like you wide sided the green, you're 4 or 5 feet off the fringe, but it's really not puttable. And the pin is 60 feet across the green. Well, shot that I learned when I was a little kid that I still use a lot is I basically putt it with a 4-iron. I take my 4-iron, I take my putting stance, my putting grip. I grip it lighter because the 4-iron is lighter than the putter, and I set the club up where it's more up on its toe, and I just basically putt it, and it gets it just enough loft to fly it over the edge of green. It rolls out pretty much like a putt would, and, you know, to get it within 5-6 feet of the hole or better.
Well, that works well when you have the your chip has the flag all the way on the other side of the green. You've got to so you're going to want this ball to roll. You want the ball to be on the ground as long as possible, but you got to get it onto the green first.
I got to get on the green because if I hit that long hard putt through the collar,
right,
and the collar isn't really smooth. Now, when you go to the U.S. Open next week at Pinehurst, I was out there a couple weeks ago. Fabulous place. They'll be putting from all over the place because there's only going to be two cuts at Pinehurst. There's going to be a green cut and a fairway cut. That's all it's going to be. There's no deep rough at Pinehurst. It's going to be wonderful. But, you know, but if you have a good smooth surface, your worst putt's probably going to be as good as your best chip. But if you do have to get it over some scruffy stuff or even a sprinkler head or something like that, that putt with a 4-iron or even a 4-hybrid, it's a good shot. You can go spend 5 minutes with it around your putting green to get a feel for it and put it in your arsenal.
I actually recently that happened to me. I was on the fringe, but the ball was setting just up against the taller grass, right? The rough there. So my putter just couldn't cut through that. And so I pulled out my 4-hybrid and hold it. I mean,
that's fabulous. And
yeah,
some people say that's the place you want to use that belly wedge. But let me tell you, unless you practice that belly wedge, man, it's a wonderful shot. Don't get me wrong, man. You need to practice that because the ball comes off a lot hotter off the edge of the sand wedge than it does off the face of a putter. A lot hotter. And if you're hitting that little belly wedge shot and you're playing for it to be really, really hot and you swing a half an inch low, 3/4 of an inch low, you just hit your little wedge putt about 4 feet.
Yeah.
If it goes that far.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you might double hit it.
Now, explain. I'm not exactly sure what you mean by belly wedge.
Where you set the wedge, the ball's up against the collar.
Yeah.
You can't get anything on it.
Right.
So you take your sand wedge and you just hit the ball right in the equator with the leading edge
of
the wedge.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I could not. I would not have the confidence to pull that one off.
Yeah.
That has got to be, you really got to practice that.
Yeah, you do.
All right. So now let's take the scenario of you're 10 feet off the green, and yet the flag is only a few feet. You know, you don't have to go all the way. You don't have to roll it forever, but you definitely got to get the ball in the air to get on the green because there's a sprinkler head in your way or something. But you don't want the ball to roll far. So what is the difference in that shot versus what you talked about your 4-iron?
Well, I think there you're going the opposite. You need high loft on the club, as Dave Stockton said, and you'd like it to stop pretty quickly. The biggest problem that people do with that shot, first of all, short shining yourself is not the way to shoot good scores. So you want to keep those to a minimum. But chances are that shot, the, you know, you might have it where the green's going to kind of run away from you possibly, but you know, 6 feet long of the hole is just as good as 6 feet short of the hole. So make sure you don't get so cute with it, as they say, that you dump it and have that shot over again. It doesn't have to stop short of the hole. And so on that shot, you know, typically you want to lay the face open a little bit, and you want to pick the club up a little quicker to get a little steeper angle of descent, and look at the back edge of the ball, right where the ball, and you know, right at the spot of the ground, right behind the ball, and drop that club again with gravity, drop that club down to that slot, and you know, with a little bit of follow through, it should pop up for you. But again, that's a shot you need to practice. And what's really a good little exercise late in the afternoon, just take your, you know, couple of wedges, your gap in your sand or whatever, and go out around. You know, you don't have to be on a green. Go to the driving range, get you a bag of balls, and nobody's over there, and just chip around, hit little different shots, see what swings produce what ball flights, and chalk those up to memory. Learn what your golf club will do. You know, you can get a bag of balls and go out to the range and the far end of the range if it's not crowded, chip around on the tee line, and then go hit them all. Get you some practice in.
You gave me a tip years ago that I still repeat, I still think is one of the great ones, and that would be looking at the front of the ball, aiming for the front of the ball.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in that. With most of your shots, you know, keeping kind of focus and not just look at the ball, look at the front edge of the ball, the side toward the target, and it makes your contact crisper. It helps me get fine. It's the old aim small, miss small thing. Let me look at the front edge of the ball because I want ball first contact. The shot that I was just talking about, and I'm going to shift my focus over to the back of the ball on that one. If I'm in the bunker, I'm going to shift my focus to a spot behind the ball.
Love that tip. Love that tip.
It really makes for crisper shots.
It really does. It really does. Because so many times when you're in that situation, you hit about 4 inches behind the ball, and then the club face bounces off the ground, hits the top of the ball, and it goes nowhere.
Either that or the club sticks in the dirt and the ball didn't move at all, and that's really fun.
That's really embarrassing. Oh, my.
Yeah.
So one of the things...
I had a 4-foot shot, and I hit it 0 inches.
Oh, that's called a practice swing.
Yeah, well, not.
One of the things that people frequently ask about the score golf clubs is that you don't have a sand wedge, right? You have the different lofts. And again, explain how 4161 works, score golf 4161 works. And then let's talk about what a sand wedge is and why you don't have a designated sand wedge.
Well, first of all, score 4161, the name comes from the fact that we make every golf club from 41 to 61 degrees, make 21 different club heads. Because over on this set of irons, your 8-iron may be 37 degrees. On this set of irons, it may be 39. On this set of irons, it may be 38. And what we want to do is be able to exactly gap the short end of your set 4 degrees for a long hitter, possibly even 3. For a shorter hitter, maybe 5 degrees. We want to give you the exact gapping. So if you have a 37-degree 8-iron, your prescription is probably 41, 45, 49, 53, 57. Well, nobody makes those. I don't want to go bend around on a golf club. These are my precision tools, so we do make them. And it lets us have infinite control over your gapping to get you down to these differentials between clubs that give you what you want. And the reason we don't call anything sand wedge, gap wedge, whatever, because they're all scoring clubs. I mean, I talked a while ago about walking into a bunker with a 47 and a 51. I got a long bunker shot. That VSOL design that we have that's been proven for 25 years, it works regardless of the loft. I mean, we were out messing around the other day hitting flop shots with a 43. I mean, who thinks about hitting a flop shot with a 9-iron? But you can do that, and it gives you another shot if you're willing to go play around with it and experiment with it. But, you know, the idea is if I have a real close bunker shot, not much green to work with, not much carry to do, the 58 or 9, 60, 61, that's a great golf club for that because it's going to pop up a little higher and stop a little quicker. But if I left it down and it rolled back maybe to the middle of the bunker and the pin's up in the middle of the green and I got a 30 or 35-yard bunker shot, I got to put a pretty big cut on it with that 58, and I don't want to make that big a cut on it because if I catch it a little thin, it's over the green and out of bounds or whatever back there. So that shot, I may take a 55 or even a 51 and just make a more controlled swing, let it come out lower and run across some of that green instead of trying to fly it all the way to the hole.
Mm-hmm. Explain to me again, you talked once about why I remember specifics of the conversations that we've had, but we've had so many conversations, that's probably why. But the loft difference between what I think was you explained, the driver to the five iron versus the scoring clubs difference?
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, when you look at golf club ads out there, go to the website and look up every set of irons online that sold, and you always got a picture of a six iron, maybe a seven. Used to be a five back in the old days before lofts were chained. But, and these guys make every iron in the set look like a six iron because we've been schooled for years that that's what a match set looks like. But what we've learned over the last decade with the advent of these things called hybrids, that when I get down below the six and I get to a five or a four, I get into that mid-20s, even high-20s, particularly low-20 loft range, this thing called a hybrid is a hell of a lot easier way to make a 22-degree golf club than to make it look like a six iron. You know, three irons are really hard to hit. I'm sorry, they're really hard to hit for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've replaced those lower lofted clubs that are only 6 or 8 degrees stronger than a six iron. We've replaced those with hybrids. But we still have this 9 and P that are 16 and 17 degrees weaker than a six iron that look just like our six iron. Well, that's a very different golf club. The illustration you referred to is a six iron in today's world is about 29 to 30 degrees in most cases. Okay, so my P is 44, so that's 15, 16, 17 degrees maybe between my P and my 6. But if I go 15, 16 degrees the other way, I've got a driver or a 3-wood.
Hmm.
So I've got on the 6 iron down, I've got a driver head, a 3-wood head, a smaller head with a 5-wood on it. I got a hybrid, maybe two hybrids, and then an iron, and then my 6 iron. But the other way, I've got four clubs that look just like my 6 iron, the 7, 8, 9 pitch, and then three or four clubs that just look just like a 1959 wedge. I got two head designs for everything from 30 to 60 degrees, and I've got five head designs from 30 to 12 degrees. There's just no logic to that whatsoever. But, you know, only on a couple of occasions have companies said maybe a match set of irons shouldn't match at all, but they never were there with commitment. You know, if you believe that, then don't make any that do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what score golf. So in your score golf set, there's 41 to 61 degrees. There's 21 degrees. There's seven different head designs. The weighting changes every 3 degrees aloft. Each 3 degrees, there's another head design to take you down the next three. So we optimize weight distribution for the exact loft of that golf club so that you get better trajectory control, which is distance control. And, you know, at the short end of the set, your misses are long and short mostly. And if your misses are left and right, the club didn't have anything to do with that. That's swing path and club head at face angle. Long and short, the club had a lot to do with that, but we've all been taught it's our fault.
Mm-hmm.
Score golf is absolution. It's not your fault. You can't control your distance.
Well, again, everything that you've offered, your advice, it's amazing how the insight that you have on the game. But you come from the manufacturing side, from the design side of clubs. I play Mizuno clubs as irons as well, but I've replaced that end of my set with the Score Golf, and I just was amazed how you, based on the form that I filled out on site, how you knew which degree lofts that I needed and how well it's worked for me. I've made it work for me.
Well, there's a mathematical science to all this, and thank you for the kudos about being a golf club designer. But, you know, I'm first and foremost, Fred, I'm a golfer. You know, I want to hit it closer to the hole just like everybody else. And, you know, what drove me to become a designer, because I'm not an engineer, I'm a golfer. And like Mr. Hogan was not an engineer, he was a golfer. And his constant pursuit of how to make the golf ball be more controllable led him to, you know, zero in on the golf club, because that's what you're controlling it with. And, you know, I think that when I have a golf club in my hand and I have a hard time flighting the ball down, well, I know how to flight the ball down. That must be the golf club, you know, because I know how to do that. So why should I be able to, and kind of what drove the whole development of Score 4161 is with my 7, 8, 9 iron, I can very accurately, I've learned over the years, very accurately to change my ball trajectory and distance to 3 and 4 yard increments in between those clubs. But I never was able to get there with the pitch and wedge and the wedges. And it finally dawned on me, maybe it's not me. Maybe it's the golf club. So when we put conventional wedges on Iron Byron and took impact in a 1-inch circle around the face, and we found that the ball traveled 45 to 50 feet different between the bottom of that 1-inch circle and the top of that 1-inch circle, well, hey, an inch isn't very far. And then we put these thin face cavity back irons on the Iron Byron, and we found that that difference distance differential went to 70, 80, 90 feet between high in the face and low in the face with the same swing from Iron Byron. That's the golf club. We've isolated the golf club. It's not the golfer. So like I say, it's not your fault that you can't control your distance, but Score Golf can fix that for you. And we will make you as good as you are. How's that?
They'll make you feel more confident, and that is huge.
Exactly.
That is huge. So the Ben Hogan, I want to get back to Ben Hogan Company for a second in Fort Worth. You've always been in Victoria. Is Texas is closer to Houston, isn't it?
Victoria's down close to the coast, which is, you know, one of my loves beside golf is saltwater fishing. And Victoria's close to the coast. But when we took on the Ben Hogan opportunity, there was no question in my mind that Ben Hogan had to go back to Fort Worth. That's where that company has always been. Just like moving the Packers out of Green Bay, it's just not something you do, you know. And the Ben Hogan Company is rerouting in Fort Worth. By this time next year, Ben Hogan Irons will be earning a following all over the golf marketplace.
I cannot wait.
It's going to be exciting.
I cannot wait. I am so excited.
And they'll be
about
made
that.
Right there in Fort Worth, Texas.
So how far is it between Victoria and Fort Worth?
Five hours.
You drive or you fly?
I drive and get a lot of phone time in. And so I have second residence I'm setting up in Fort Worth. And I'll be spending a bunch of my time up there. It's a wonderful city, by the way. And, you know, nicknamed Cowtown. It's the beginning of the West. And wonderful city. Really neat place.
Yeah. Definitely the best part of the Dallas-Fort Worth area is Fort Worth.
Yeah, West Fort Worth is just a really neat place. And a lot of great golf there, just great people there, some of the best little restaurants you've ever found in your life, and it's a really cool place.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, congratulations again, Terry. Really happy for you, and eagerly anticipating what happens in 2015 with Ben Hogan. And when you guys are about to release something, I'm going to drag you back in here and let everybody know once again.
Well, that'd be great, Fred. We'll look forward to that opportunity and to spending more time on the show.
Yeah, that would also be fun. It's always great to talk to you. And again, I want to remind all the Golf Smarter members that if you go ahead and click on the link and go Fourscore Golf at golfsmarter.com, it'll take you to Score Golf. You'll get all the information you need. You can ask questions. You can email back and forth. You can call them. The customer service is so important over there, and you will find that out when you deal with them. But make sure that if you speak to somebody or do it online, that you use GS Member as your checkout code, so you're going to get 15% off your purchase. Terry, congratulations, best of luck, and thanks again.
Thank you, Fred. It's always a pleasure.
If you use Twitter, you can follow us at Golf Smarter, hashtag Sound Advice, and if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. Please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.